Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
A daily amount of walnuts is linked to a longer life and improving the risk of fractures. We're also going to talk about how cacao or chocolate can make a difference, and especially for your skin. And that's in a major study. We're going to talk about how children who take ADHD medications have problems sleeping. That's University of Nebraska. And PMS. Millions of women suffer from it. It's actually an early marker for future high blood pressure risk, and that can kill you. University of Massachusetts. What to do about these things? We look at the problem, but more importantly, we share the solution. A lot more also on health and healing today. Then, I'm devoting a lot of time today to the questions of the conflicts in the Middle East. I've invited on our program Ray McGovern. Now, Ray is well known to many people in the progressive community. He served as an Army intelligence officer and a CIA analyst under seven presidential administrations, from the John F. Kennedy White House to that of George H.W. Bush. And he prepared the Daily Brief, which is a one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors. So in other words, he was the one who collected all the CIA national security data on intelligence and gave it to the people who gave it to the president. So he has an insider's knowledge. He holds degrees in theology and philosophy from Fordham University, also a background in Russian history, a graduate of Harvard, and also he has a theological background from Georgetown University. So he's a multi-talented person. We're going to talk about the Turkish downing of the Russian fighter jet and how the American media and Al Jazeera are playing it wrong. But also today, a special commentary from Chris Hedges, State of Terror, from Truth Dig on this topic. Merchants and Menace, How U.S. Arms Sales Are Fueling Middle East Wars, William Hartung from Counterpunch. We're going to talk about Blame the West Interventions for Today's Terrorism, Stephen Kisner from the Boston Globe, and Hitting Saudi Arabia Where It Hurts, Robert Perry from a Consortium News. So those are the issues we're taking on, and it's going to be a packed hour. Let's begin. I'm a big believer that we should have raw, healthy nuts every day and seeds in our diet. They are different from fruits and vegetables. The oils they give us are different. The phytonutrients they provide are protective for our heart. If you were to look in each one of the nuts background, let's say walnuts, pistachios, macadamias, cashews, almonds, you would find they have some things in similar, but they have a lot of unique qualities to that particular nut. Therefore, the variety of nuts taken is what matters. So if you were to eat walnuts on Monday or walnut butter, depending upon your digestion, if you're having digestive problems, as some people do, and the older you get, the more likely you don't digest things well, especially nuts and seeds, hence you avoid them. Or you might have dental problems, so you don't want to eat seeds, you want to get them stuck. So you take the butter. Now the butter is simply nuts that have been pureed. That's all it is. Butter doesn't mean dairy, it just means make it into a very soft consistency, which actually makes it more digestible. Because then your stomach and the hydrochloric acid and the enzymes don't have to go to work with lipase in the stomach, a digestive enzyme that breaks up fat, or protease and pepsin for protein. It can go into a higher degree, probably around 85 to 90% absorption, meaning that nutrients from the nuts and seeds are actually absorbed in the cells, and that's what you want. People don't understand that, and they miss out on something if they don't. If you were to eat raw broccoli, or cauliflower, asparagus, or cabbage, only a small amount of the nutrients are actually going to be absorbed because most of it's going to go right through your body undigested. The lignocellulose is just too tough. When you steam it, you break down those fibrous tissues, allowing the nutrients inside the cell to become more readily and easily absorbed. And the whole purpose of eating something is to get the absorption of the nutrients, and then a quality fiber to sweep the dead cells and bacteria that are no longer beneficial out of the body. So it works well. Nuts are a part of that. Here's the latest study on this. This is from the British Medical Journal. Quote, eating a daily handful of walnuts is linked to better overall diet quality and improvement in certain risk factors among people at high risk of diabetes. The walnut diet was associated with improvements in blood vessel cell wall function and lowering the bad cholesterol after 6 months. Walnuts are a rich source of essential fatty acids and folate, vitamin E, associated with health benefits. And so this is the latest study, and this was a good study, and it showed it made a difference. So take the walnuts, take the almonds, take the pistachios, not toasted and salted, but raw. That's how you want them. Next up, University of Nebraska. I'm quoting, stimulant medication for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, that's ADHD, cause sleep problems among children who take them. And this is a new study. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Pediatrics. This was known as a meta-analysis. Meta means many. So they looked at many studies to come up with these findings. And this was through the Department of Psychology. And here's what they found. Quote, we would recommend that pediatricians frequently monitor children with ADHD who are prescribed stimulants for potential adverse effects on sleep, because they found it. Why is this important? By the way, they screened, you ready for this? 10,000 articles to come up with this. Now, my thoughts. I believe that this is important. That's a good scientific review. You don't get any more comprehensive than that. But it's not going to mean a single thing. First, because no one's going to change how they prescribe. They don't do anything more than refill prescriptions anyhow. They're not doing detailed analysis by sitting with the parents and the children. And also, the entire field of psychiatry or mental health in children and teens is flawed. How do I know? Well, because I study it. Also because I've counseled thousands of parents with children. I've done a clinical study where I took a group of kids who had been diagnosed with ADHD or ADD and were on medications, primarily Ritalin, but also Adderall and other stimulants. These are a very powerful way of influencing the brain, biochemistry, in a negative way. And I then looked at all the science. Do these actually improve a child's study? No. Get them better grades? No. What it's doing is it's impacting them but causing gross fatigue. They can go high and low very quickly. A lot of them have insomnia. A lot of them lose their appetite and become very skinny and malnourished. But here's the point, and here's what everyone's missed, and it's right in front of you. One of the very first things that will get you diagnosed as ADHD is if you're fidgety in class, if you go to sleep in class, if you distract yourself in class, then it's off the psychologist. More often than not, you're going to get an immediate diagnosis, and then it's the psychiatrist, and then you get you're in the mental health care system for life. Because once you're on their computers, you can't get out of it. If you or I, as adults, were to stay up late and not get a good night's sleep, we wouldn't be happy campers the next day, in all probability. How often have we seen a child, youngster, an adolescent, toddler? We say it's nap time. And sure enough, the crying, the whining, the complaining, they take a nap and they feel better. And by the way, adults, it's the same thing. To give yourself a 15-minute nap each afternoon, even if you're not into a sleep, just relaxing, meditating, listening to some nice, soft music that can help restore your energy in just a matter of minutes. You feel better, more focused, more grounded. Now imagine that you want to get a good night's sleep, but you couldn't because you're on a medication. The medication, then, is causing a lack of sleep, so therefore you get to school the next day, and the only way you can stay awake is you take caffeine. Caffeine makes you hyper. It's a neurotoxin. I should know, my doctoral thesis was in caffeineism. I did a long-term study on it in the lab. It has about 7 qualities that you would consider positive and a lot more that are negative. And when you consider the average teenager today is consuming over 500 milligrams caffeine minimally a day, and 1,000 is toxic, meaning you can die from it. So now imagine that you're using your cell phone, you're using your computer, you're staying up late, you're eating foods at night, you don't get a normal night's sleep even without medication. Now give the kid medication, and they're wired, and they're distracted. And when you're distracted and you're wired, you're not going to be able to pay attention, which means then the teacher's going to say, oh, Jimmy's got a problem. Well, the problem is, yeah, Jimmy's got problems, plural. The medication he's on for the condition he doesn't have, that was a fraudulent condition, always has been, and any psychiatrist who is asked directly, can you prove to me a brain chemical imbalance and difference between serotonin and dopamine that would justify a clinical basis of diagnosing this kid? The answer is no. Well, how about for schizophrenia? No. Manic? No. Is there any mental condition you can prove is a chemical imbalance in the brain? The answer is no. There is no evidence. However, even the ads on television, when they're asking you to take an anti-anxiety medication or an antidepressant medication, watch very quickly because it comes almost in white line so you can barely see it. It says that it's not proven, but what they'll say is, we believe. Something like that. They're hedging. There's no science to it. So now imagine that under most conditions, a teacher, and most teachers do the best they can, just understand how much a teacher is faced with in a given day. They have to do far more than what people give them credit for. They have to be there to be a person that helps guide them, to help them learn critical thinking. Unfortunately, today that has been usurped by the school system and the charter schools to taking tests. Well, how does a test actually prepare you for the world outside? It doesn't. Cheating on these tests. So when kids are not learning and they're all failing state exams or entrance exams, what do? We simply lower the standard and cheat and lie and say, and this was just in the paper yesterday, that one school in New York City, not a single kid passed the test. Not one that would show that they were qualified to go into college. Not one. You can't blame the teacher alone on that. That's the system. That's the protocol. That's the environment they're in. So in any case, now you're judging a kid to have a disease that does not exist in them. You're not looking at the fact that vaccines can cause subtle brain changes in some kids and full Asperger's and autism in others. It's a spectrum. But if you are brain damaged only by not having proper brain communication, it cannot be diagnosed. There's no technique for diagnosing it. So you simply look for patterns of behavior and then say, Jimmy's acting out. So now Jimmy's acting out, maybe because he's tired, maybe because he's on a caffeine and sugar rush, maybe because Jimmy is bored with the class, maybe because Jimmy doesn't have any discipline from home going into the class, maybe Jimmy's very bright and the class is being taught at a lower level to float the standard. Maybe Jimmy has been sleeping with his cell phone by his brain and it's adversely affected and inflamed the brain, so the brain is reacting inappropriately because it's inflamed. Until you take all these into consideration, and then finally the cherry on top is looking at all these 10,000 studies, they said, yep, give your kid an ADHD drug, and they're not going to sleep, and gee whiz, what does not sleeping do to the immune system, your attention, your energy, your focus, your temperament, and your disposition? Put those into the equation. When I did that, we were able to take kids who had been on medication for years and were brought them back to normal. So any school teacher, principal who would like to discuss this and see the protocols I use, I'm happy to share them with you. If there's any school in New York City or the tri-state area that where I could get to, I'd be willing to do the following. And if we have some conscientious and caring administrators who can sign off on it, because you'd have to get approval, I'd be willing to take any class that you have and take a class that is high levels of ADD and ADHD diagnosed and treated children. They're on meds. And then take a class that has none. And see by working with the class that is loaded with these children, by changing the circumstances, their diet, and giving them a different protocol, if within 3 months we couldn't change them at least 50% to normal. I would have a board-certified psychiatrist, a board-certified psychologist who would oversee it and be able to present the results. I would simply provide the protocol, speak with the parents, speak with the teachers, and I would do this, of course, as a public service on my time and my dime. You can, anyone who wishes that can reach out and can contact my office at 646-926-5422. Because all we have to do is do it in one school and then see the results, then duplicate that in six schools, see the results. Now, I did it in a charter school. There's a woman in this audience. Her name is Gray. She's a very conscientious school teacher. She opened a charter school in New Jersey, in Newark, and she invited me in, and we used my protocols, and there was such a remarkable change. It was so radical, the difference, and we filmed it. From the first day when I was speaking with the teachers and the parents and the children, to the last day when the children got up and talked about the changes, the parents got up and talked about changes. One young girl got up and said, "I'm so happy because my mom was on all these medications for high blood pressure and diabetes and obesity, and I was afraid she was going to have a heart attack. She's lost all this weight. She's no longer overweight. She no longer has diabetes. She no longer has high blood pressure. I got my mom back." And when you hear that time and time again, in a whole school, the entire school cooperated. That should have gone out to all the other schools, so that people knew there's another way. Now, I realize you got to fight the completely inept Board of Education, which I'm totally opposed to how they manage the school system and curriculums. You've got a lot of obstacles. I'm aware of that. But we have solutions, and most people are not aware of that. You get parents seeing the change in their children. You see children seeing the change in their parents. You see teachers cooperating and working with them, administrators working together. Then we have a paradigm changer. So if it's not now, maybe in the future, but I'm available, and I will help you show what a lifestyle and behavior modification could do, so we no longer have 10 million children taking medication, and many of those children end up killing other kids or themselves. Next up, from the Seoul National University in Korea, how cacao, or chocolate, flavanols can boost skin within 24 weeks. Quote, "High flavanol cacao supplementation may have positive impacts on facial wrinkles and skin elasticity in photo-aged Korean women." And this was given in 320 milligrams a day, which is a small amount. And they had an improvement in skin roughness. Their skin became smoother. An improvement in wrinkles. And this was a placebo-controlled study. And it was published in the Journal of Nutrition. So, that's something we didn't know. We knew it was good for your heart. We knew it was good for the epithelial lining of your arteries. We knew it was good for your brain. Now we see when you're taking your chocolate and try to get high percentage, preferably raw, and don't have the dairy with it. And so that's good. PMS as an early marker for future high blood pressure. This is important. University of Massachusetts, I'll quote it, published in the American Journal of Epidemiology. In the first prospective study to consider PMS as a possible sentinel for future risk of hypertension, epidemiologists Dr. Johnson and colleagues at the School of Public Health and Health Sciences, University of Massachusetts, Amherst, and Harvard School of Public Health report that women with moderate to severe PMS had a 40% higher risk of developing high blood pressure over the following 20 years compared to women experiencing fewer menstrual symptoms. So, here's what I'm going to do. On an upcoming program within the next week, I will give you, and it'll take about 20 minutes, I will give you a comprehensive protocol to help prevent, eliminate, in some cases completely, PMS. And the diet behind it, and everything else that is involved. So that's the problem, because remember, if you're at a higher risk of high blood pressure, then a high percentage of people with high blood pressure end up having strokes. And a high percentage of people who have strokes die of the first stroke or second stroke. But a lot of people have many strokes. Now, listen carefully. This is so important. When you get angry and you lose it, okay, we all do. That's not the problem. The problem is when this becomes a pattern of behavior, not just one-off, you can create many strokes. Tiny little strokes. They're not going to kill you, but they end up creating scar tissue and effect, little plaque in the brain. Some people, when their brains were autopsied, had hundreds of these little lesions in there. That's from many strokes. When you're more even-tempered, when you're calm, that's not a problem. So just follow the connection here. Poor diet, you end up imbalancing your biochemistry. That ends up causing you to end up being more susceptible to high blood pressure, which ends up causing you to be more susceptible to stroke, which causes many strokes, especially if in the process of being moody you end up angry or stressed, both of which increase your risk of death. So let's see if we can't change that and save some lives. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a break and come back, and then we go into some serious stuff. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world. We're going to go to some commentaries in a moment that I believe will help us better understand the world that we're living in and address some of the issues. And also then we'll be joined in about 12, 14 minutes with Ray McGovern. But just a little side gift today to all of you in the audience. This happened because last night when I was getting my evening juice to start my evening work in counseling, a woman came up and said, "I become a vegan for the first time after watching your film supporting WBAI, and I haven't touched meat, and it was as bad as going off coffee. I have a craving for it when I smell fried chicken and all this, but I've refused to have any animal protein in my diet, thanks to you." She said kind of strangely, and I said, "Okay, that's good." She said, "But now I'm going to have my Thanksgiving, and I don't know what to eat." And she says, "Do you have any ideas?" I said, "Of course I have ideas. There are a lot of healthy things you could have, and it would be fun and be different." And I said, "Listen today to the program, and I'll give it to you." Oh, by the way, as a good aside, anyone in the audience who has a van or a truck or a large car, please call us, because The screening of the film raised over $11,000 net-net, and as a result, the station is able to pick up premiums, hundreds of them, and get them out. They just, they've been sitting for months. Please call so we can get these premiums to the listeners vis-a-vis BAI, because they don't seem to be coming by and picking them up. And I know that Mitchell Cohen and others will mail them right out, and that'll be great. All right, so call 646-926-5422. It will take probably two trips with a car or one with a van. All right, but what I'm going to do now is I'm going to let you know that I created a vegan, gluten-free, gourmet alternative meal for Thanksgiving, including, and these are all my recipes, what you see in the photographs, you can see the photographs and the complete recipes. These are all my original gourmet vegan recipes. The dessert is the raw chocolate mint coconut cream cake. Now, you're going to look at it and say, I can't make that. That's too fancy. Yes, you can, and I show you how. Then you want to start with a nice appetizer and an avocado dip, but beautifully displayed. If you're watching over the live stream, you can go to Ustream and watch today and go to Gary Noll in there. You can see the pictures. A beverage, a power berry blend, a soup, a papaya yam soup, and which is delicious, and then the salad. Now, let me see if I can get this up for the camera. No, you can't see it that well, even with a high-def camera here in the studio. But it's up on the website, and this pear beet salad looks like it came out of the pages of Gourmet Magazine. And then finally, the entree, sweet and sour tempeh. Delicious, vegan. Most of these are raw. This one is lightly cooked, but it'll just breathtakingly delicious. And you won't end up laying on the couch for 17 days wondering, did you eat some lead if you eat the average American meal? So how do you get these? Go to GaryNoll.com or my Facebook. For the people who go to the Facebook, it's there, or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and you can download them, and you have the photographs and the recipes, and try them, right? If you're a single person, these are easy to make. If you're a family, you can make it a whole five-course meal, all right? Hope that helps you. Ray McGovern is on hold. I gave you his background earlier in the program. In a few moments, he will be discussing the Turkish downing of the Russian fighter jet. I wanted to share some views of my own and others on this topic before we go to him. In Chris Hedges' view, in States of Terror, it is nearly certain, I think most of the listeners would agree, that we will endure sooner or later another catastrophic terrorist attack on American soil. The blundering of our military into the Middle East, the failed states that have risen out of the mismanagement and chaos of Iraq and Afghanistan, and Libya. By the way, Libya was the wealthiest country in Africa before Hillary Clinton and Obama and others decided NATO to destroy it. Mind you, this is the same NATO that is now making threatening postures against Russia and China, as if they were the problem. The reality is the millions of innocents we have driven from their homes and terrorized, slaughtered. The bankrupt puppet regimes we have equipped and trained that will not fight. The massive amounts of munitions and military hardware we have allowed to fall into the hands of jihadists, thousands of them carrying Western passports, and the myopic foreign policy whose single tenet is that more industrial violence will get us out of the morass created by our industrial violence in the first place means that we, like France, are in for it. All the major candidates for president, including Bernie Sanders, I keep saying this repeatedly, Bernie is great at challenging Wall Street's excesses. He is no different than any other president we've had when it comes to foreign policy, even worse. And as I said the other day, he wants and has actually gone on record of wanting more to be done by Saudi Arabia to get their hands dirty. Well, maybe I missed something, Bernie, but unless I missed something, if you, Bernie Sanders, went over to Saudi Arabia and said, I want you to get your hands dirty, the likelihood is their hands would be in destroying you because of your sexual orientation and your beliefs. They would not be respected there. I'm sure that in support of what you do, and I commend you for standing up and being honest about all this, that you are not also honest about all the people who suffer who have similar orientations in those countries, including Saudi Arabia. Even someone who believes in Sufism would be considered a heretic and would be killed. Saudi Arabia is the cause of much of the crisis we have in the world today. In the United States, all of our intelligence agencies are fully aware of it. They train and fund jihadists. They have the most radical form of Islam, Wahhabism. And these people are literalist. And there's no room in their equation for cooperation or conciliation or apology. So giving them more power, how exactly does that benefit people? What would Syria look like if Saudi Arabia and Egypt were able to see that the current Assad regime is thrown out? It would be a failed state just like Libya. And to what end would that benefit the world? No, lost are the all on all this is true diplomacy, the ability to read the cultural, political, and linguistic and religious landscape of those we dominate by force, the effort to dissect the roots of jihadi rage and violence, and the simple understanding that Muslims do not want to be occupied any more than we want to be occupied. Another jihadi terrorist attack in the United States will extinguish what remains of our anemic and largely dysfunctional democracy. Fear will even more fervently stoke and manipulate our policies. The remnants of our civil liberties will be abolished. Groups that defy the corporate state, Black Lives Matter, climate change activists, and anti-capitalists will be ruthlessly targeted for elimination as the nation is swept into the Machiavellian world of us and them, traitors versus patriots. Culture will be reduced to sentimental doggerel and patriotic kitsch. Violence will be sanctified in Hollywood and the media as a purifying agent. Any criticism of the crusade or those leading it will be heresy. The police and the military will be deified. Nationalism, which is at the core of this, the self-exaltation and racism will distort our perception of reality. We will gather like frightened children around a flag. We will sing the national anthem in unison. We will kneel before the state and the organs of internal security. We will beg our masters to save us. We will be paralyzed by the psychosis of permanent war. And if you doubt me, watch Fox, watch MSNBC. Read the publications that are supposed to define the ideologies of those that care most about us. In more time, public discourse amidst the insane sputterings of King Lear. What did he say? Then kill, 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 kill. Demagogues bellow for more bombs and more enemy corpses. The military and the war profiteers provide them. The public cheers on the slaughter. Victory is assured. The nation rejoices when the newest face of evil is eradicated. But when one face of evil is eliminated, there'll be an endless supply of others behind it. Violence generates counterviolence. The cycle does not stop until the killing stops. All that makes us human, love, empathy, tenderness, kindness, is dismissed in more time as useless and weak. We revel in a demented hyper-masculinity. We lose the capacity to feel and understand. We pity only our own. We too celebrate our glorified martyrs. We endow our sanctified dead with the lofty virtues and goodness that define our national myth, ignoring our complicity in perpetrating the ceaseless cycle of death. Our drones and airstrikes, after all, have the decapitated far more people, including children, than Islamic State. Jihadist troll websites in the dingy quarters of housing projects outside French cities and in the slums of Iraq cities, looking for young people discarded by war and neoliberalism, just as army recruiters sniff out our young own American discarded and disposed and send them off to fight. Disenfranchised youth offered the illusion of heroism and glory and even martyrdom, promised a chance to be armed and powerful or seduced by these scavengers. Hundreds of millions of people across the globe have been cast aside by globalization as human refuge. They are worth nothing to the corporate state. They are denied jobs, benefits, dignity, and self-worth. They are easy prey for the siren calls of those whom war is a lucrative business. They dress in uniforms. They surrender their individuality. They experience the intoxicating drug of violence. They assume a new identity, that of warrior. By the time they see through the illusions and lies, by the time they grasp how they have been used and betrayed, they are broken, maimed, or dead. No matter. There are legions behind them waiting eagerly for their chance. We have lost the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq, as a unified nation, has been splintered into antagonistic and warring enclaves. We will never be united. We ensured that Iraq would become a failed state the moment we invaded and disbanded its army, police forces, and government bureaucracy, the moment we fruitlessly attempted to dominate the country by force, including our arming and organizing the Shia death squads that carried out a reign of terror against the Sunnis. The Iraqi insurgents, Al-Qaeda, and later Islamic State easily recruited the masses of enraged, disposed individuals whose families have been torn apart since 2003's invasion, whose childhoods have been colored by extreme poverty, fear, a lack of education, basic services, and horrific acts of violence, and who correctly see no future under U.S. occupation. Islamic State now controls an area the size of Texas. Yep, carved out of the remnants of Syria and Iraq. All our air attacks will not drive them out. The situation is no better in Afghanistan. The Taliban controls more of Afghanistan than it did when we invaded 14 years ago. The puppet regime in Kabul we arm and support is hated, brutal, corrupt, completely, totally, absolutely, 100%. You cannot find an honest politician in Afghanistan, or Iraq for that matter. And dare say, only a couple in the United States at any level. And yet we imagine this to be otherwise. The Kabul regime will crumble the moment we depart. Trillions and trillions of dollars, along with thousands of lives, have been squandered for nothing. We waded into conflicts we did not understand. We were propelled forward by fantasy. The occupation of Iraq was supposed to have been seen as greeted by SS liberators. We planned to implant democracy in Baghdad, and we have then to spread it around the Middle East. We were fed the absurd promise that the oil revenues would pay for reconstruction. Instead, our folly spawned political, social, economic collapse, widespread poverty, massive displacement, misery, and rage that gave birth to a radical jihadism in Iraq and throughout the region. And yet, we still rely upon these individuals who told us this would all be possible in this new utopia of peace, democracy in the Middle East. We still believe them. We still read the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN. Why? And exactly who has apologized? Judith Miller? Who? Mr. Keller? Who? Dick Cheney? Rumsfeld? The Clintons? Obama? Who? None. The disintegration in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan has forced us to form a de facto of alliance with Iran to battle Islamic State and the Taliban. This disintegration has upended our goal of overthrowing the Syrian regime of Bashar Assad. We now function along with the Russians as Assad's surrogate air force. In endless war, yesterday's enemies eventually become today's allies. This is a theme George Orwell captured in his dystopian novel, 1984. At this moment, for example, in 1984, Oceania was at war with Eurasia in alliance with Eurasia. In no public or private utterance was it ever admitted that the three powers had at any time been grouped along different lines. And so it is. We live by massive violence. We employ that violence domestically through our police state, which has been fully militarized, and in all matters, domestic and universal. Nice to have you with us today, Ray.
Hello.
Hi, Ray.
Hi, Gary.
Ray, Turkey is a member of NATO. In my opinion, NATO is a completely criminal and corrupt organization. And yet it was, I cannot believe that NATO was not aware, nor the United States and our national security agency and Pentagon, that Turkey would shoot down a Russian plane without some communication between them. So I'd like for you to talk about that. Also, is it not true that Turkey has been offering safe refuge for ISIS and other terrorist groups and allowing them to be funded, armed, trained through Saudi Arabia and Turkey to go in there, and yet we're considering Turkey and Saudi Arabia as our allies in the war against terror? What am I missing here that just doesn't seem to set right with me?
Well, you know, it's very confusing, Gary, because the basic question is cui bono. Who profits from all this? It doesn't make sense for the United States to be including the Saudis in negotiations and continuing to supply them with tens of billions of dollars worth of arms, including TOW missiles and all kinds of other sophisticated weaponry. And then ask the Saudis, please, would you be part of our coalition while we bomb the hell out of all these people that you've armed and that you've supported? So I'll get to the cui bono in just a second, but with respect to the shootdown, the Turks are Turks. And as long as they have a reasonable expectation that Obama and the rest of NATO will come to Turkey's side on these kinds of things, like the Israelis, they prefer to ask for forgiveness if necessary and not prior permission. So my take on this is that the Turks, whether they had a kind of a wink from the likes of Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland or some of the other neocons who also want to get rid of Bashar al-Assad, the president of Damascus, whether they had that wink in a nod or not, they're quite capable of doing this in the full knowledge that the president, as he did, comes up and says the same thing that he always says about such acts. Take Israel, for example. Israel has the right to defend itself. Turkey, in this case, Turkey has the right to shoot down a Russian plane after, as the Turks themselves recounted, a 37-second incursion over what the Turks claim is their airspace. So, sure as could be, the U.S. did come to their aid. Now, what are the Turks trying to do? As you mentioned, the Turks not only are giving safe haven to ISIS and other terrorist organizations, but they're giving them safe passage. And so they come from the Saudis, fully armed and equipped. They come around, they come into Syria and Iraq. And what's the game here? Well, Turkey wants to obliterate the Bashar al-Assad regime in Damascus, and we have several examples, prior examples, of this taking place, and the Turks doing overtly or covertly what will facilitate this in their view. I refer specifically to the August 21, 2013 sarin attack outside of Damascus. Now, what happened there? Well, UN inspectors were going into Damascus to investigate what the rebels were claiming were sarin attacks against them. And they arrived 2 days before August 21st, 2013, when there were these small sarin attacks outside of Damascus. Now, they were immediately blamed. John Kerry got up and said, I counted them 35 times, Bashar al-Assad's regime, Bashar al-Assad, the government, and he did this, okay? And guess what? He didn't do it. Who did it? The rebels. over the rebels. Where they make the salmon? Turkey. Okay, how do we know that? We know that from Cy Hirsch, the most reliable investigative reporter, except for Bob Perry, that I know. Now, were they able to publish that in America? No. No one would take it, so Cy had to go to the London Review of Books. But it's very, very clear that the game was this. We're going to mousetrap Obama. The way we're going to do it is we're going to get him to say that there's a deadline, that if you cross the deadline and use chemical weapons in any fashion at all, that's the end. That's, we have to recalculate our policy towards Syria. Well, very conveniently, the provocation crossed the red line, and Obama was on the verge of using French fighter bombers and U.S. missile ships off the east coast of Israel and in the Middle East to do shock and awe on Syria. What happened? Well, two things happened. One is that we got information, I'm talking about my former colleagues, that the salmon that was used had gone through the British reprocessing or British verification thing, and they found out, whoa, this was not the salmon that was in Syrian government stocks. This was homemade salmon. And that got word to the president just in time. Meanwhile, my former colleagues in CIA were saying, we're not going to sign on to an intelligence assessment here because we can't prove this is Bashar al-Assad. What happened? Then the Russians come in. You got a problem, Mr. Obama? We think we can help you out. Really? Yeah. I will talk to the Syrians, and we think that we can get the Syrians to destroy all their chemical weapons. And Obama said, really? And the next day, Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, and the Syrian counterpart said, yeah, we can destroy all our chemical weapons. They were all loaded on U.S. ships and destroyed. Now, why do I go through all this? Well, because the Turks missed out on that one because honest analysts wouldn't abide by it, and even the British when they looked at the sign. So this is number two. Here's Erdogan, the head of Turkey, seeing a very dangerous chance of peace happening, peace breaking out. Talks have begun in Vienna. My God. Russia is included, and also Iran. We got to do something to put the kibosh on this. That's how I read this. This is to stoke tensions with Russia. I think, I had to think about this all day yesterday, I think that that Putin, his sang-froid, which has been amazing, it seems to me, over the last 2 years, I think he'll see this for the provocation that it is. I think he will not respond militarily. But serious consequences will apply. And I think Obama, when he finally gets wise to what's going on, will renew his relationship with Putin. And there is still, I think, a chance for working this out at the negotiation table rather than still arming more terrorists.
Ray, one final question. Also, your voice is coming a little muffled. Could you speak directly in the phone? I'd appreciate it.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Thank you. Turkey changes its borders by keeping the region unstable and, of course, doesn't want an independent Kurdistan because it is so oil-rich. Turkey has now been confirmed to have helped the jihadist rebels in the false flag lethal sarin attack you just mentioned outside Damascus. They tried to blame it on Assad. This was a whole campaign. It was a campaign by our CIA and National Security Agency and NATO. They all wanted this to be what we did to Gaddafi in Libya. It would have been over in a matter of days. And then they would have had all of the anarchists take over. Now, the U.S. NATO priority to remove Assad, therefore, supports moderate Islamists, what they're calling freedom fighters, what John McCain has actually taken photographs of himself with these people. First and foremost, Russia has about 40% of all the heating oil that's used in gas, I should say, in Turkey comes from Russia. Their largest group of visitors from Europe and Eastern Europe comes from Russia. So Putin doesn't have to do anything militarily. He could economically make Turkey suffer. And the man heading Turkey is a tyrant. And no one talks about what he does to other people who've wanted independence in his own country. And also the fact that they have on record the supplying of the weapons, the training, and the safe haven in Turkey. Why won't anyone look at this for what it is? And is there such a thing? Have you ever seen in all your years as a CIA analyst a moderate terrorist?
Well, even Obama 15 months ago said that this was a charade. There aren't any moderate terrorists in Syria. They're all dentists and lawyers and so forth. So they have been resurrected, okay? They've been sort of like Lazarus, brought forth from the tomb, and now we have so-called moderate terrorists. Now, if that's what it takes to get some decent folks to, or almost decent folks, to negotiate with the worst terrorists and figure out some solution for the government in Damascus, well, that's all right, as long as things remain on the negotiating path. But there are really, really strong influences here. And first and foremost, next to Turkey, is Saudi Arabia. Now, not many Americans know, because this is somehow kept out of the news, that we sell, the latest deal over 5 years is $100 billion. Okay, that would be billion with a B, all right, in arms sales between Washington and Riyadh. Now, why do I mention that? Well, you know, I was amazed that Pope Francis had the guts to get up before Congress and say one of the main problems is, quote, the blood-soaked arms trade, end quote. Well, there it is. The Saudis are stoking this insurgency in Syria, and we are giving them tens of billions of dollars worth of arms every year. So, cui bono? Who's profited from this? The blood-soaked arms traders, that's who. And until the United States can sort of evolve from this military-industrial congressional complex and say, look, we have to confront the Saudis. The answer always is, well, then the French, the British will send them. No. Well, we have to confront them. We have to get together with the French and the British and say, look, knock it off.
They're not, Ray, you and I both know that they're not going to do that, because you're talking about $100 billion a year profit that is to be made by these companies. Let me read what William Hartung from Counterpunch has to say on this. An article, Merchants of Menace, How U.S. Arms Sales Are Fueling Middle East Wars. Quote, the recent surge in U.S. arms transfers to the Middle East is part of an unprecedented boom in major U.S. arms sales that has been presided over by the Obama administration. The majority of Obama's administration's major arms sales have gone to the Middle East and Persian Gulf, with Saudi Arabia topping the list with $49 billion in new agreements. This is particularly troubling given the complex array of conflicts ranging throughout the region and given the Saudi regime's use of U.S.-supplied weaponry in its military intervention in Yemen. The Obama administration has made arms sales a central tool to of its foreign policy, in part as a way of exerting military influence without having to put boots on the ground in large numbers, as the Bush administration did in Iraq, with disastrous consequences. The Obama administration's push for more Middle East arms sales has been a bonanza for U.S. weapons contractors, who have made increased exports a primary goal as Pentagon spending levels off. Not only do foreign sales boost company profits, they also help keep open production lines that would otherwise have to be closed due to declining orders from the Pentagon. And then it goes into examples. One more thing on that. So it is all about the money. It's either oil on the ground or gas over there, or regime change to get it, or making sales to those countries from here. There's one other thing we're not talking about. This is a clip I'd like for you all to listen to. People, why do people become Islamic extremists? This is a short clip. Please listen to this.
What drives someone to become a religious extremist, even to the point of becoming a suicide bomber? Like most people, I assume that there were two overriding answers, poverty and ignorance. The poverty line goes like this. Grinding poverty from which there appears to be no escape fosters seething resentment against those who have more. If your choice is to die a martyr or die a beggar, martyrdom is the clear winner. The ignorance line goes like this. The poor have no chance to get a decent education and thus are susceptible to easy manipulation. Clever people play on their prejudices and superstitions. Once the extremist gets this ignorant, poor person in his grasp, indoctrination is easy. Since there's plenty of poverty and plenty of ignorance around the world, that's a lot of people to draw from. This is how the source of terrorism is explained. Then I went to Pakistan and actually lived in the world from which extremists recruit, and I found something much different than I expected. Poverty had little to do with who became an extremist. Lack of education even less. Many of those that I met who subscribe to religious extremism and are prepared to murder and die for their cause are from the middle class, and many had a university education. These are not poor people, and these are not uneducated people. They are well-fed and well-read. So if poverty and ignorance don't drive people to extremism, what does? One is a desire for meaning and for order. Places like Pakistan are submerged in chaos and corruption. Islamists promise clear-cut solutions to every problem. Here's how things will change if you follow these rules, and only these rules. Another is a desire for change. The old corrupt order, the narrative goes, must be overthrown, and that can only happen through violent action. Again, it is Islamists that step in with a promise to create a new form of government. Then throw in a strong sense of victimhood. We are not responsible for the sorry state of our country. Others have brought us down, and you have a toxic brew that many willingly imbibe. These, of course, are the same easy answers that tyrants and demagogues, from Lenin to Mussolini to Hitler to bin Laden, have always offered their followers. I saw this played out one day while living in Pakistan. After one of the many assassinations of a major figure there, I was sitting with two middle-class parents. The father owned a small business, and the mother was a nurse. They had given their son a good life. He wanted for nothing. They told me that during dinner with the family a few days earlier, their son noted how the person who was murdered deserved to die. Why? Because he had spoken out on behalf of religious minorities. They were shocked. How could their son, who'd been educated and well-raised, think that? This story is all too typical. So what to do about this extremism? The first step is to get off this false narrative that this is first and foremost a poverty or education issue. The second is to take on the narrative of the extremist groups. They promise a better way, but what in fact do they deliver? The answer is always more death, more suffering, and more poverty. In other words, young people need to see these extremist groups for what they are. Only then will recruitment numbers begin to go down. Third, the media have to stop treating extremists as freedom fighters, a narrative that is all too common in places like Pakistan. Fourth, teachers and parents cannot assume that just because they reject religious extremism, their children and students will too. Middle-class parents and teachers have to be vigilant in instilling moderate, pluralist values in their children. Fifth, politicians have to stop blaming their country's problems on the West and have to confront the endemic corruption that destroys countries like Pakistan from within. Sixth, and probably most important, Islamic religious figures have to stop looking the other way, or worse, glorifying so-called martyrs, Muslims who murder innocent people, almost always other Muslims, in the name of Islam. Muslim religious leaders must promise these murderers eternal damnation, not some sort of twisted heavenly bliss. The people of Pakistan and other Muslim-majority countries have real grievances, but extremism only makes things worse, always and everywhere. It's not poverty and misery that creates religious extremism. It is religious extremism that creates poverty and misery and death. I'm Haroon Ullah, adjunct professor at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service for Prager University.
Thought you would appreciate that insight. Ray McGovern, final thought.
Well, all I'll say is that a number of things just mentioned are hopeless, but the situation itself in a realpolitik sense is not. The Russians are a completely new factor here. They fear terrorism, and they legitimately fear terrorism in their own country, the Chechnya and the others. And they will be a factor for working things out with the U.S., the French, British, and so forth. The other thing is that there's a chance now that Obama in his last year will exercise the leadership that's necessary, and that means calling the Saudis out. getting the French and the British to help him call the Saudis out. First thing he could do is release the 28 pages of the Joint Congressional Inquiry on 9/11, which shows that without Saudi financial and other support, 9/11 would never have happened.
Absolutely.
That will make an impact to the American people. And other things that he could do is simply say, look, $100 billion a year, that's more than we give the Israelis. Not a year, that's over a five-year period. And we know who's profiting from this, who's going to stop that. So it's not hopeless, it's just that it requires some leadership, and the Russian factor is a new one, and I think a helpful one if it's not rejected by the West.
Ray McGovern, thank you very much. RayMcGovern.com or ConsortiumNews.com. Nice to have you with us as always, Ray.
Most welcome.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you for listening. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.